You're listening to a Flower Pot production.
Hello, gorgeous person. Welcome to the next chapter and thank you so much for choosing this conversation. Now, before I introduce you to today's guest, I have a very quick favour to ask. If you could follow this podcast wherever you listen, well, this would help us so much. It's our mission here at Flowerpot HQ to encourage as many women and men to live lives they truly love and help you know your dreams really can come true. And when I say we, well, it's just me and my Labrador dog Cookie and you now, so this helps so much. And if you think someone you know will also enjoy this conversation, well, we'd love it if you shared it with them too. Now, on to today's guest. Today, I'm going to introduce you to the brilliant author, Jacqueline Beard.
Never too late. Never, never, never. It's a mindset. You can do anything that you want to do. I mean, I didn't start writing. I must have been in my late 40s, I think, before I started writing and publishing and doing that sort of thing.
Jackie says she grew up everywhere as a child. She moved around a lot. Now, perhaps all these different locations were planting the seeds of Jackie's curiosity to discover where she came from. Because later on, she became a genealogist. It was when she discovered a murderess in her ancestry where she realised there was a story she wanted to write. Today she writes fictitious Victorian murder mysteries based on all her discoveries of the stories she's uncovered. She's now written 20 novels and they're enjoyed all around the world. Now, if you've ever thought you'd like to write a book but don't know how or where you're going to find time, well, Jackie here is going to tell you everything you need to know. She writes all around her full-time job and she has created a life she truly loves. Jackie says this was her first podcast interview, but I think you'll agree she is a natural. She's warm, humble, and has learned how to follow her own heart. She believes in the power of tiny steps taking you to where you deep down know you really want to go. Hello and welcome to The Next Chapter by Ellie Barker. The idea behind this podcast is that as I navigate my own next chapter from TV journalist to author, I speak with incredible people who've already started their next chapters in the hope it might help you with your next chapter, or at the very least, you'll just enjoy the conversation. So here she is, Jacqueline Beard. Jacqueline Beard, well, I've been very much looking forward to speaking to you, so welcome to The Next Chapter.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you told me you were a little bit nervous, Jackie, but I don't think you need to be nervous because I've read your story and you've got an incredible story. So I cannot wait to share it. So we will just crack on. So when I asked you where did you grow up, you said you grew up everywhere because you came from a military family.
Yes, I did do. My father was in the Royal Air Force, and so we travelled all around the world with him. So what was some of my earliest memories are growing up when I was really quite small in Malaysia. And I think I was only sort of two or three, so I don't remember a great deal, except coming down to the garden gate one morning to find a dead snake on there. It was it was quite nice, you know, and I still remember a few of the sights and smells of that. But yeah, that was the earliest memory, Malaysia. And then later on, we obviously came back to the United Kingdom. Generally in the Air Force, at least back then, you moved at least every 2 years. So it was a constant round of moving from one county to another county. So I've got quite a strange accent now, really. It's a bit of a hybrid from everywhere I've ever been. Then we were in England for quite a long time. And then when I was about 10, we moved to Cyprus and spent couple of years not far from RAF Akrotiri, which is obviously in the news a bit at the moment. We were in a little military base nearby called RAF Episcopi, and it was quite an idyllic childhood there in many ways. You know, mum would let us go out and we'd play on, well, the Bondu, which is a sort of great big space really, where, you know, you're just running free and, you know, we could go anywhere we wanted as long as we were back for dinner. It was all very lovely. Then two years later, back to England, and then 2 years here, 2 years there, and finally, you know, I left school and that was that.
Wow, God, what an experience though. And how did you find that to keep, did you just get used to it going into different schools and meeting new children?
No, you, I don't. I think it depends what sort of personality you are. I was quite a quiet child, and I'm a colossal introvert, so not necessarily the best for people. And I need a lot of downtime to myself and that sort of thing. And then constantly having to restart, I find that quite hard. But I knew a lot of people who didn't, who really enjoyed meeting all these new people and going to these new locations and starting these new chapters and new lives. But yes, there was upsides and downs. I mean, we went to some lovely, beautiful locations and beautiful places, but the school was always quite difficult, I think. And of course, no sooner had you settled in and got used to it than you were off again. So,
Sure. And were you an only child, Jackie, or do you have brothers and
no.
sisters?
No, I'm one of three girls, but I was the eldest, and I had a sister 18 months younger than me. But due to the school system back then, you took a school exam, and you could either go to a grammar school or a comprehensive. So I went to the grammar. My sister went to the comprehensive. So we didn't school together at any point. And then my third sister was 6 years younger than me. So, she was in the lower school altogether. So we sort of all forged our own paths in schools.
Yeah, okay. Well, what an experience, though. And so your favourite subject you said was creative writing. Do you think as well,
Yes.
does that, am I being a bit cliché, but that sort of bought into that, but the fact that you were an introvert and then this was a way that you could use your own imagination, I suppose.
I suppose so. I suppose I was just quite good at English, not so much at English literature or even necessarily comprehension, but in terms of writing, I remember getting told off a few times at school for being asked to write a couple of pages and sort of coming back with 20 pages of exercise book filled with whatever story it was. But it was definitely my favourite lesson by a long, long way. And I always did better in the essay-based subjects. I enjoyed history and geography and anything where you actually got to do a bit of writing. So I think, I've always had a bit of it in me, but I didn't know for a very long time because I didn't start writing till quite late in life.
But even back then, when you were told to write a story, you could just like you could just re you know, you found it very easy to do.
Yes, it was never an effort at all. It was just a piece of paper, and I filled it very quickly. And yeah, that was that. I'd never remember having any difficulties with that. Whereas you look at a piece of comprehension and you're still staring at the same page 10 minutes later, it didn't sort of fill me with the same eagerness.
No, I can understand that. But you wanted to be a vet, but you joined the military.
I wanted to be a vet for years, but I think a lot of children want to be a vet, don't they? If you love animals, and we sort of got our first dog when around the time when I wanted to be a vet, and I loved her very much, and I think that formed a lot of the opinion about being a vet. But inevitably, I came from a family where my dad was in the military, my uncle was in the military, my dad's dad was in the Merchant Navy. There was a bit of a track back about being in a military family. And I suppose I just at one point wanted to do what my dad did. And so I joined the military myself, and yeah, I'd spent 10 years in the RAF.
Wow. And did you travel around then as well?
I did. I sort of did all my training all over the place. Went to RAF Swinderby in Lincolnshire, then rapidly to Herefordshire. And then Biggin Hill, which was a lovely posting in Kent. That was really nice. And then I got posted abroad to RAF Rheindahlen, which was sort of on the border of Germany and Holland. And, it was a super posting. You could see an awful lot there. There were 70 bars on the base, perfect for a youngster. And I did have a very lovely time there. And then eventually, after a couple of years, I was posted back here initially to where I live now, and then to the very north of Scotland, where I spent a couple of years at RAF Lossiemouth, and that was another lovely posting. Absolutely beautiful scenery up there, right on the end of the Whiskey Trail, and there was a lot to commend it. And then back here again to pretty much the same posting. And after 10 years, I sort of I'd had a child by then, and that was sort of quite early on, really. Initially, you couldn't if you had a family in the RAF, you had to leave. But then things changed. I had my daughter, and it's a lot easier being single in the services, I think, than being a married mother. So after a while, I left and then settled here, not far from Cheltenham.
Amazing. God. So you really did travel around though, Jackie. My goodness. I mean, by that stage, I can't imagine how many different places you'd lived in.
Yeah, quite a lot. I'd never even actually counted them up, but it was a lot of uprooting and change, and that's what I've been used to all my life. And I suppose, you know, it's good on the one hand, very interesting, and you see a lot. But on the other hand, you're constantly packing up and moving and saying goodbye to people and moving on. And, you know, there's two sides of that coin, I think. But I think it probably gives you a lot of life experience.
Sure. So how old were you, if you don't mind me asking, how old were you then when you settled there with your daughter in Cheltenham?
I think I was in my very late 20s. Okay. And yeah, so I she went to nursery, so I continued working, but I left the RAF and I joined an estate agency and worked for them for quite a lot of years. And then I sort of ended up working for quite a lot of estate agencies. I think I probably then spent the best part of 2 or 3 decades in and out of a state agency, which was another very, very interesting job. I mean, you see an awful lot of other people's houses and the way other people live. And that was a very interesting time as well. But settled, you know, although I might sort of move to the occasional local town for work, I wasn't all over the globe by then, so it was a lot easier and a lot easier to have a family life. And, you know, my daughter's upbringing was very stable.
Yeah. So were you a single mum?
Only briefly. So I was married and then divorced. So I had my daughter in that marriage. Then I spent 18 months as a single mum, and then I remarried and eventually had my son. So there's quite a big age gap between my children. I think there's 11 years between them.
Okay.
They get on very well anyway.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. And did you have any family around Cheltenham at all? Were you really sort of setting up a home on your own?
No, and I suppose that's the thing. I've always been very distant geographically from my family, who lived on the other side of the country. I've got a big East Anglian heritage, and that's where my family are now. So when I first had my daughter in the north of Scotland, we were hundreds of miles away from the nearest family, which wasn't mine. And I mean, it was a 10-hour drive to get to my family. And same over here. So, you know, there wasn't always a lot of support, although my second husband's local. So, you know, there was a little bit more support later on when my son was born. But you just manage, though, don't you?
Yeah, that's a lot, though, being an estate agent. My brother's an estate agent, so I know. And it's hard work. But also, yeah, you do see it all. I mean, you do.
You do see it all. Yes, they get a very harsh rap, though, estate agents. They're very, very hardworking people. And, you know, it can be a difficult job, you know, very long hours. But yes, you do see some interesting sights and meet some interesting people. And it's a great job. I'd recommend it to anyone.
That's amazing. And it's and the selling of the house, don't even get me started. But that's how they do it all the time. How you do it, I just don't know. I don't know how he does it. But so you became an unqualified hobby genealogist.
Yes. So I've always been very, very interested in my roots and where I came from. And when I say I've always been, I have been sort of more as an adult. I wish I had been more so as a child, when I could have actually asked grandparents, you know, things that I needed to know. But I don't know what it is about rooting around in my past, but it's just been so fascinating. And I really badly wanted to know where I came from. My dad grew up in Ilford, and he was evacuated in the war, went over to Devon, and his widowed mother visited him there when he was evacuated and liked it so much that they actually ended up moving there. So then he joined the Air Force, moved all around the globe. And so I would ask him questions about, you know, what happened previously, where he came from. And as far as he knew, he was born in Essex. That's where he came from, and that's where everybody lived. So we actually started doing some family history research together, Dad and I, back in the days when you had to go into London and go to the records office and do it all manually. By which time he'd sort of settled, retired and sort of settled in Ipswich, where his last job was. So we went down to the records office, tracked back the records, and found out unbelievably that he actually in fact came from Suffolk a long, long way back, and his latest ancestor was born in the village he had subsequently moved to, having not even known he was Suffolk born, let alone known that was his ancestral village. He's sort of like a pigeon coming home to roost, really.
God, isn't that strange? Isn't that unusual? But is it unusual? Because obviously this is what you went on to do. So you've just done this, you say, for years and years, and 30 years later your family tree contains over 50,000 genetically related relatives.
Well, I checked that the other day, and I've underestimated that. It's over 60,000. So I think you could call it an obsession, not a hobby. Yeah. I mean, it's just something that's always interested me. I've always wanted to get back on every side of my family tree. My mum came from Norfolk, and so I've got Norfolk ancestry, but she also, her mother came from the mines, and so I've got mining ancestry. I've got very elusive Irish ancestors. Cannot find for love nor money. I'm desperate. One day I will find them, but it's a harder part of genealogy. But I've just been working on it for years, and it's a lot easier now because you can go into the internet and find out a lot about your heritage from there. And then latterly, DNA tests. So while my mum was alive and when my dad was in better health, I asked them if they would kindly have their DNA tested, which they did. So now I have a sort of DNA links that I can follow up as well. And they've broken down a lot of family history walls for, you know, things that interest me that I haven't been able to solve by records alone.
Amazing. Do you think that, Jackie, so on this podcast, I do often bring out my very amateur psychology, and it is and it is amateur, I want to just point out. But do you think, and maybe sometimes I read a bit too much into it, but like with all that moving around that you did, this was like to get the real, literally the grounding and the roots of where you came from. Do you think that had anything to do with it?
Do you know, I've never thought of it like that, but it makes such logical sense. Yeah. That maybe you're right. Maybe it is. Yeah, that sounds very likely.
But I suppose it's just the fact because you had such a moving around childhood, and then in your 20s, and then it's a real grounding, isn't it, if you know where you've come from, and then to find out that you know, going back to a place where like your dad, that, you know, that's where his ancestors were, it's just it goes to show, because we have like links. I live in Bristol, and my bestest of friends, she also now lives in Bristol, and it's strange how and my husband's friends all live around Bristol, and it makes you wonder, like, we're all drawn to this area and you don't really know why.
Yes, it's almost like you home, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like a pigeon or something. But I think there probably is a lot to be said for that. And I think, you know, people cluster together, and maybe you don't always know why. Maybe it is some dormant instinct. And maybe I'll write a book about that one
maybe
day.
Maybe you will. There you go. Look at that. And so that neatly moves us on. So for example, today, you carried on working in the estate agency. Today you work as a finance manager in a local theatre. So is that in Cheltenham?
No, it's in Tewkesbury.
Oh, nice.
So the race traffic is no longer a problem for me because I drive north to work every day now, which is it's lovely, and it's absolutely unbelievable working in a theatre. You're surrounded by so much creativity, so much talent. I fangirl every day when I look at the colleagues I work with. You know, they all have some stake in the arts, even though they might be doing sort of normal jobs, you know, commercial, marketing, whatever. I work with an award-winning Olivier director. I work with singers, with actors, with dancers. They're so talented, my colleagues, and so knowledgeable. And it's just a lovely environment. You can sort of walk out the office and there's a sound of singing above you, which is the choir performing, or, you know, there's always a movie on or a show practicing. So you're surrounded by sounds, and, you know, we have a lot of incredible people at the theatre, people who volunteer and come in and look after, you know, help look after us. It's a really wonderful creative space.
How wonderful. And I love Tewkesbury. I've covered Tewkesbury again with my job as a journalist. I did the Tewkesbury Mop Fair.
Oh yes,
oh,
yes,
yeah, yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that's a lovely one. The other one they do is the Tewkesbury Medieval Festival as
nice,
well, and
nice.
That's wonderful. They do the reenactment of the Wars of the Roses, and you know, everybody's dressed in medieval dress. I even wore a medieval dress last year, which was Yes, my son sort of talked me into it. I'm not sure I'll do it again, but you've got to be part of it, haven't you? But it's always a wonderful day out.
Oh, how wonderful. A lovely, lovely part of the world you live in and work as well. So that's incredible.
I do.
So to move on to the writing then. So you found a murderess, I love this, in your family tree at the same time as discovering several suffragettes.
I did. Yeah, so the preface to all of this is I'd taken a writing course, and as part of the writing course, I had to write the first chapter, appropriately, of a book, and it was a child's book I selected. And the long and short of it is I decided, well, if you can't write a chapter without writing a book. So I wrote a child's book, and then after I wrote the child's book, I thought, okay, if I can write a child's book, can I write a book for adults? And as you say, at that time, I just found a murderess in my family and suffragettes in my family. And they were both at completely opposite ends of the scale. So the murderess was actually not genetically related to me, but she was, married into the family. And she was actually the last woman to be hanged in Ipswich Jail. And she murdered her wife horribly. Her name was Mary Emily Cage. She murdered her wife, James, by arsenic poisoning. And it was a gruesome death. You know, he really suffered. And on the face of it, it looked like she was just an incredibly evil woman. But when I started researching her story, she was born into the most extremes of poverty. You know, it was unimaginable the levels of poverty they suffered. And when they went to investigate in her house, literally the only thing in it was a bar of soap. There was nothing else, no food, no nothing. And she brought up 11 children, three of whom had died. And she was married to this man who was actually very, very violent and abusive. And all these things sort of conspired to turn her story into, you know, a tragedy. I mean, when she married him, she was all hopeful and young and expecting a nice marriage and everything. And it turned into an absolute nightmare. He ended up in prison. She ended up being absolutely pilloried by the local media of the time. And, you know, all the blame was focused on her. But, you know, if that had happened in this day and time, they'd have considered her background and what she'd suffered as well in a way they never did at the time. But I found her story absolutely fascinating. And my suffragette ancestors were from the other end of the scale. They were from the rich part of the family, and they lived in a lovely part of Ipswich near Christchurch Park. But they were very dedicated to their cause. And there were two kinds of suffragettes. They were, you know, the activists, the suffragettes, and the suffragists, who were like political activists and you know, worked without violence. And they would do things like evading the census. You know, if they couldn't vote, then they wouldn't be there to be counted on census day. So sort of I read this story about the census evasion, and I knew the two of my ancestors had been there, and they'd sort of hidden away from the enumerator when he came around. And so I set my story around these two things, and the extremes of poverty and the murder and the suffragettes, and the book literally fell out of my pen. I mean, it was just such an easy one to write. I loved doing it, and I felt like it told quite a powerful story in the end. It is one of my favourite books.
Incredible. That's incredible. And also, what are you on having so much empathy as well for the murderess? Because you could have easily written her off, quite literally, but actually you could, and that creates the story.
I mean, I think that's the power of research, and that's why I really enjoyed writing historical mysteries, because you get to set the ending as well. It doesn't have to be the ending that happened in real life, although I generally try to choose things that were not necessarily resolved or provable in subsequent books. But yeah, I'd spend months and months and months researching. And I think if you research carefully and with an open mind, everything isn't quite as it seems. And, you know, my books tend to have sort of themes. That book had poverty as a central theme. The one I wrote next was, you know, powerlessness of women and that sort of thing. It inevitably creeps into books somehow when you actually see how things were back then and how difficult times were. But yeah, it was a fabulous book to write, and yeah, I will always have fond memories of the research.
I bet you do. And before this, Jackie, when you said you did a writing course when you wrote that first chapter for the children's book, had you been writing since you were a child? Had you, because you'd found it easy then, but had you done any writing?
No, not really. As part of the job I was in at the time, I wrote a newsletter for an estate agent every month. So I did a bit of that sort of writing, and I'd written a couple of articles for a magazine that were estate agency based. And I thought, oh, I quite like this. Maybe I should do something with it. So I just did quite a short writing course. There was nothing much to it, but it's one of those things you think, okay, if I can write a chapter, can I write a book? If I can write a child's book, can I write an adult's book? If I can write an adult's book, can I write a series? And that's sort of how it progressed until it's like, right, I've written one series, can I write another series? And you're just taking little steps, and if you like, making new chapters time after time in writing, and you know, as each of your ambitions are realized.
It's yeah, absolutely. And breaking it all down, but and also what a wealth of experience you've got with all your traveling around, with your estate agent working in the theatre, and then all your family tree. I mean, that is you, that you're, and actually I must say, Jack, before we talk about the publishing, is my husband, he's a crime journalist, so he does it for does true crime, obviously, for he covers mainly for our news, but he's written books and podcasts and Gone, which is out at the moment, is actually based on his which is on ITV, coincidentally, is based on inspired by one of his books. So he's really fascinated. And he, when I was telling him about you, he was, because he loves history, but also he said, by doing it how you're doing it, like you say, you're not tied to the facts, so you can let the facts inform you, but then you can have some freedom with it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of thereafter, I did try much harder to look at sort of unresolved case mysteries, things that had never been sort of finalised. So there might be a death or a killing, but it didn't sort of come to anything. And then, as you say, you can choose your own endings. But I did try to work it in a way that it really could have happened, you know, sort of following the trail of things that the evidence that actually happened, and coming to my own conclusion that could have been a real thing possibly, you know. I didn't ever deviate too far from the facts, because I think it's important to stay as close to the facts as you can if you are reporting something historical. But of course, if it's a mystery and it ends up unresolved, then you know, the only way you can finish it is by creating an ending, but it shouldn't be ridiculous.
No. Okay. Yeah. And also, but I suppose you're so well read, you kind of get a feel for what is ridiculous and what isn't. So did you first self-publish that, your first novel?
I sort of did. The first three books I wrote, I went through, I suppose you might call it a vanity press, but in fact they weren't. They were actually a really good little publisher with very, very reasonable rates. And I only ever did it for friends and family. You know, I just thought I'll put a few books out there. And it was a very, I don't have any regrets about using them. They were excellent. But sort of three books in, I realised that actually I could do it all myself. So I thought, you know, it was another one of those. If I can write a book, can I publish a book? So I thought I'd give it a go. So I did. I published one of my books. And then I thought, well, if I can publish a book, can I advertise it? So I was following the Self-Publishing Show podcast at the time quite a lot. So I bought their course and learned how to do that, marketed my books. And suddenly I found that people were buying them, you know, and so I formed my own imprint and carried on doing that and wrote, I don't know, I'd sort of got to about 10 books, I suppose. And then I, as you know, ended up joining Vinci Books as well. But, you know, to start with, I was very much self-published and self-marketed. So, you know, I had to learn it all myself.
Incredible. So when you said, because obviously, and I used to work with James Blatch, who does the self-publishing show.
Did you?
Yes, I did, as a journalist, actually. So too am a big follower, and I learned, I mean, they owe them so much. I owe them everything, really, because they sort of opened up the world. So did you, when you say you did 10 books, how long did that take you, Jackie? Because you must have been working very hard.
Well, I mean, to start with, I just wrote a book and then I left it for a few years. And then I wrote another one. And I sort of were only writing one book every couple of years at that one point. But you sort of get the bug. And after I wrote The Fressingfield Witch and I knew I was writing a series, I thought I better take it a bit more seriously. So then it became one book a year. And then it became two books a year. And then one mad year, I wrote three books on a novella in a year.
Wow.
Which I rush to do again, because I'm not necessarily a quick writer. I know people that can write 10,000 words a day easily, but I've got a full-time job and I've got to fit it in amongst other things. And there's no way I could keep that sort of pace. But yeah, I think I wrote my first book, I think, in 2014. My second, I want to say 2017. My third, 2019. And then here we are now, and I'm writing my 20th book at the moment.
That's incredible. So how do you do it when you say, because obviously you work full time, where do you fit your writing in?
Well, a lot of writers will tell you you should write every day, but I don't think I'd enjoy it. I tried it once and I didn't like it very much. Yeah. So I have a really set pattern. I write 3,500 words a week, set over two sessions, on a Monday night when I get home from work, because Monday's always tough, and on a Thursday night. And it doesn't matter how I feel. It doesn't matter if I'm sick. It doesn't matter if I have other plans, which I don't, because I cancel them. Monday and Thursday evenings are sacrosanct. And I turn up at my desk however I feel, and I write the words however hard it is to get them out. And then that's a book, you know. And it takes me about four and a half months to write it, and then it takes me another couple to give it a good editing before it goes off to my editor. So I like it to be as sharp as it can be before it goes anywhere. And so I have been sort of in recent years doing sort of two books a year, but you know, mostly two books a year, I would say. I always give myself December off.
That's great. And you find then. So you've got a real system, because I think that's what it's all about. It's about having a system, whatever it is, Jackie. What I understand from all these next chapter conversations, it's about having a system that kind of works for you, whatever that may be. And that's the whole point of it. So you do it twice a week, 3,500 words a week.
Yeah.
And that gives you two books a year.
It does. And I mean, I totally understand and admire the way other people write. And, you know, there's not a one size fits all in writing like anything else. But I'm quite a self-disciplined person. But if I allowed myself the luxury of whether I write or whether I don't write, I wouldn't.
No.
I'd go off in the garden or walk or do something else. So I sort of hold myself to account. And also I have, you know, writing friends, an author friend of mine, Glenn. He's my sort of writing partner who holds me to account, you know, my accountability partner. I think it's really handy to have something like that and somebody you can sort of spin off. And because at the end of the day, for me, it is all about discipline. You know, it's sometimes, often you just don't feel like it. Other times, like yesterday was great. It just fell out the pen, but you never know what you're going to get. And it often depends on how things are during the day and, you know, whether you've had a good day or a bad day, whether you're tired or whether you're hungry, hangry or whatever. So,
But that's the point, isn't it? You sit down and do it. At the time you say you're going to do it, you do it. And do you plan in advance?
Yes, I always plot. So I'm quite old fashioned. My starting point for plotting is a whiteboard. So I scribble all my ideas on a whiteboard and then I sort of get them together and make a Word document out of it. And then I will rearrange them into sort of one or two line chapters. I'll know exactly how many chapters I'm going to have. My books are always around 70 to 72,000 words. I always have a structure, but within that structure, it's not too forensic these days because I'm writing psychological thrillers now. So whereas they were very, very research heavy before and fact heavy, there was a lot more to it in those days. Now I just need a couple of line prompts per chapter to be able to do it, because there is not that much research involved. Although there's still a little bit, you wouldn't expect there to be, but there is. But yeah, it's a different way of writing now.
Now, I'm just going to interrupt this interview with the brilliant Jackie for a quick word from the sponsor of this podcast, my very own novella, Could We Just Do That Again? It's an uplifting romance and story of documentary maker Alice, who moves to Strawberry Village in Bristol to interview the people who live there. She thinks she knows exactly what she wants in life, but what she's about to see makes her question everything she believed to be true. Here's a little extract read by me. I still can't believe you've watched my work. Why wouldn't we? Peggy looked at Basil as she let go of his hand and flicked the kettle on. If I make the documentary about the rainforest, will it be shown in the cinema? The cinema? Well, that does sound fancy. Peggy turned to Basil. Doesn't it, darling? Basil nodded and took another ginger nut. He didn't look like it sounded fancy. Can I ask, why would you want to be in the cinema? We had a great time watching your films at home. but everyone wants to have theirs shown in the cinema. So let me just get this straight, Peggy said. You want to spend 6 months in a rainforest so it'll be shown in a cinema. Now Peggy was getting it. Exactly, Alice said. Exactly. So there you are. What will happen as Alice stays at Strawberry Village? And will she ever find a love quite like Peggy and Basil's? Well, you can download it absolutely for free at elliebarkerwrites.com. Now back to Jackie.
Vinci, that's who I work with as well, and they're wonderful. Yes. You heard about them on the self-publishing show. And so
I did.
How many books had you written by that stage?
I think 13 or 14.
Wow.
I honestly can't remember. It's awful, isn't it? I've got a terrible memory. I don't know how I exist in the world of writing with a memory as bad as mine. Have to write everything down.
Too busy writing books, Jackie. That's what it is. Thinking about your
books. Probably. But yes, I've written quite a lot, and I heard about it on the self-publishing show because I think I've probably listened to every episode they've ever made.
Wow.
It's just one of the... I follow quite a few writing podcasts. I follow your own wonderful podcast as well.
Wow, thank you.
But with self-publishing, it's just the one I really stuck with, I think. And I'd heard about this and I wasn't even entirely sure what I was submitting for, if I'm completely honest. Mm. But I went online, I put my name and details, and I went away and forgot all about it. I literally forgot it. And then we were on holiday. It was a bit of a holiday of a lifetime sort of thing. My husband and I were on a Caribbean cruise on the edges of Barbados.
Wow.
And I got this email. Like, I hadn't had internet access for a few days, and I sort of bought some and looked at my emails, and there was this wonderful email from Jane Harris, who looks after my account there, basically saying that they were interested. And I was like, I can't tell you how excited I was. Mm. And I think, you know, bubbles were had at that point.
What a place. I love that. I have to say, Jackie, that I also had an email, first of all, from Mark Smith, and then a conversation with Jane while I was on a holiday. I was in this lovely, it wasn't as exotic, it was a lovely place called Beggar in Spain, but I will always remember that moment, and it was a lovely, lovely moment. And Jane is so amazing, and to be in touch with her, so well deserved on the bubbles. And so all your books, are they through Vinci now, or did you keep some still with your Dornicker Press?
Yeah, I've got a couple with my Dornicker Press. I've got the Child's book, because nobody will ever want to read that. That's my first book. And it was...
You don't know that.
There's always an embarrassing book in your armoury somewhere, isn't there? And this one was just a little bit wild. And Vote for Murder, which is the one I was talking about earlier with the murderess, Mary Emily Cage, that's still with Dornicker. And I haven't done anything with that for a while, because you know what happens if you don't attend to your backlist. But, that is still there. And at some point in time, I'm going to give it a new cover and give it a little boost of life again, I think. But it was really difficult working full time and writing, and you know, the marketing was getting so much, and it was really lovely to be able to hand that off to Vinci. Mm. But to my immense surprise, I found myself missing the marketing. But then, it is really hard work, and it's very, very nice that somebody else is doing it for me. But I wouldn't entirely rule out doing other books, but I'm very happy with Vinci, and the quality of the books is absolutely wonderful. Mm. And they've just partnered with a Dutch publisher as well. So three of my books are going to be... readable in Belgium and the Netherlands.
Amazing.
In the fairly near future, which is fabulous, and that's something I could never have done myself.
And their expertise, you know, they've got such a wealth of expertise, and they know what they're doing, which is always good to get that, isn't it?
It's wonderful, and you know, little writery dreams you tick off, like being able to go into a retailer and seeing your book. Mm. So my books were in Asda in January and February. There may even be some there now, and you know, I was really quite you just have to go and do it, don't you? Take that selfie of you with your book in the store and all the things you sort of hope for when you're starting writing, because it takes a lot of years for most of us, I think. You know, some people have wonderful success with their first book, but for most of us, it is quite a long, hard slog, and, you know, it takes a long time to get established to any level at all, and, you know, to build up your readership and that sort of thing. So to have somebody with that level of expertise who can take it in directions you never thought you could go is just wonderful.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, like you say, you can carry on with writing the books. And so are you still writing two books a year then, do you think?
I've slackened off a little bit, and I was contemplating briefly not writing at all next year and giving myself a year off, but then I think no.
I just
can't see it. Well, it's like any other habit. Once you're into that habit, it's really hard to let go. So so I've got another book on the go at the moment, which I'm over halfway through. I think I'll probably write another one this year. And no, as much as part of me yearns to have a year off, I also think I'd be so bored if I did. Yeah. And I'd regret it and miss it. So I would imagine it will be a book or two books a year.
Yeah, I think it sounds to me, though, like you've got such a good system going on, a very manageable system. So why break it when it's working so well?
Yeah, it works really, really well for me. I think it's probably some people's idea of hell. It definitely wouldn't work for everybody. And, you know, it's just evolved over the years. At one point in time, I did used to write on the weekends as well and put 5,000 words out a week. But I really did miss those weekends. And I don't think you should ever get resentful of something you're doing. You know, I think it's really important that it fits in with all the other aspects of your life, because I still have a son at university and a dog that needs walking and, you know, various other sort of hobbies and interests. And you want to have a quite well-rounded life as well as write your books and tell your stories.
And you work full-time, as you say. So, you know, you're still very busy. So for your to be continued, I'm guessing, you would like to carry on like this.
Yes, I mean, I would imagine I will probably work for the next 5 years, short of a lottery win. I can't see that changing. And I do enjoy it. I mean, it's a really nice place to work and a really nice town to work in. But I think, like any writer, I write best first thing in the morning, and I rarely write first thing in the morning because my life doesn't really allow it. And the thought of being able to just get up, walk the dog, and then sit down and do a few hours writing in the morning whenever you feel like it, because there's nothing else you have to do, it's incredibly appealing to me. And I'd like to think that at some point in my life I'll be able to do that. So that's the dream, just to be able to walk the dog and write and do hobbies in the afternoon.
Well, that sounds like a lovely dream. In the Cheltenham countryside as well, or what's around there. Yeah. That sounds incredible. And so for your acknowledgements, Jackie, who are the people you'd like to thank who have helped you along the way?
Well, I hear a lot of writers say that, you know, oh, don't count on help from friends and families, because they don't. But mine do. I've had huge support from my friends and family all the way along. They've been absolutely incredible and very, very patient. And, you know, big kudos to my husband, because there's a lot of research involved in writing historical mysteries, and the amount of graveyards he's wandered around and museums he's been to and villages he's driven through, and, you know, the embarrassing moments where I'm taking photographs of people's houses and all sorts of things, you know, in research. And he just patiently goes along with it and drives me wherever I need to go. So he's been incredibly helpful. And as I said, having Glenn, my accountability partner, and other authors I've met over the years, and other friends just to speak to, I've got a lot of people to be, you know, grateful for. And of course, you know, Vinci as well, naturally. You know, it's been lovely having a publisher. So yeah, I'm very grateful. I've had nothing but help in my writing life, and people have been fabulous.
I think it really shows people who like are really in your corner. And sometimes that's why I think Next Chapters are so amazing, because you realize there are all these people supporting you and you'd never have any idea. And it's when you put sort of something like that out, like books, and it's so personal. But then for you, I mean, what I didn't ask earlier on, Jackie, did you ever submit to traditional publishing or to agents?
I submitted when I first wrote the children's book, I thought, well, shall I try this? And I submitted to three and never heard a word. And then when I wrote The Fressing Field Witch, I thought I'd try again. And I submitted to three. And this time I did have a bite, and I did actually get asked for, I think, three chapters or some part, some fairly large. And then it was like, yeah, it's good, but not really for us. And then after that, I thought, oh, no. And I was quite keen on the self-publishing by then, because, of course, you can do what you like when you like, yeah. Publish. You know, the level of freedom is immense, which is another great thing about Vinci, because they don't stop you writing. They don't.
No.
Told you in a certain way in terms of your writing. You write what you feel you want to write. Mm. And that's been really important to me, because I don't think you can modify facts that easily. And a lot of the writing that I do is based on things, and I want it heard the way I want it heard, you know, and to hear these people's stories. I think I've just lost my train of thought now. I'm really sorry.
I went back there. But also, I mean, but then though, Jackie, to walk into Asda and see your books there, I mean, that's incredible. What a feeling for you.
Oh, it was super. I loved it. And, you know, there's nothing like seeing your book out in the world, unless you've got your student son with you and he insists on rearranging all the shelves so your book's prominent. I had to run off and hide at that point.
Quite
but
right.
Apart from that, yeah, it's an absolutely a super feeling. But writing's full of wonderful feelings. I mean, the very, very first time you type the end on a book and you know that actually you can do it, and then you do it for the second time, which is often the harder time, and you know you can do it continually. And then when you market it and that first person buys your book and then that first person gives you a 5-star review, you know, there's so many thrilling times in writing. I mean, I'm a very, very nervous public speaker, but I've done a couple of festivals where I've had to stand up and speak. And although it's been, almost, you know, so unbelievably nerve-wracking, the sense of accomplishment at the end of it, and almost every chapter you write and everything you do gives you that strong sense of accomplishment. I recommend it to anybody.
Oh, well, I totally agree. And also, it goes back to you, like, as that girl, there you were, you know, traveling around everywhere, and you loved your writing. And I do think whatever that is that's in you, it's lovely to be able to use, and it obviously was in you then as a child, and to be doing that now and having all these wonderful experiences. Well, like, for me, that's like, that's what it's all about. Also, in subjects that you're fascinated with, I mean, you just couldn't get better.
No, I mean, I've always had sort of an abnormal interest in criminology, but also in the occult as well. And, you know, without making it ludicrous, I've been able to introduce some of that into my books. One of the books, the first book I wrote in the series, The Fressing Field Witch, I actually found a witch in my ancestry. Wow. So one of my genetic relatives was accused of witchcraft, you know, quite late in Victorian times, when they should have been well past anything like that. And it's quite a strange story. The Smoking Baby of Fressingfield, it's called. It really happened. And this woman, really not a very pleasant woman, sort of poisoned her grandchild, but did it using liniments and rubbing it on the body, and this poor baby was sort of smoking in a pram around the village of Fressingfield, and it was quite a nasty story, really, and that sort of twinned in very well with the 1600 witchcraft trials. There was also a witch then, Faith Mills, in Fressingfield, and she was pilloried and hunted down by you know, the Witchfinder General, and subjected to all these awful sort of trials and prickings and all the nasty things they did to witches back then. And so, you know, you have this sort of almost occult thing twinning in with these terrible historical treatments of women in particular. And it's just such a vast amount of research and, you know, things to write about. And inspiration, really. So so research, traveling around, it's all come together and to make up some interesting but at times quite horrifying books.
But all of it fascinating, and that's the thing. You've created this all yourself, so it's just incredible. So for your hurdle, Jackie, you said, well, I'll get you to say, what would you say is the biggest hurdle you faced and how did you overcome it?
So I think, you know, whereas some children thrive being moved around all the time and some people thrive moving place to place, I found it probably, I would say, harder than most, you know, being quite introverted and quite quiet. I would actually rather stand up on a podium and give a speech than actually schmooze in a room with six people having to make small talk. Oh, yeah. It's not my forte. Yeah. I'm not a natural chatterbox. And of course, that's what happens. You go into a new school and you're meeting new people in established groups. And, you know, they may or may not be interested in a new person who they don't know anything about. And, you know, I didn't naturally find it easy to make friends, and I was actually very happy to be that little girl sitting in a library reading a book anyway, because, you know, who doesn't love reading? But, you know, the teachers always want you to make friends and everything. But I think it probably had an overall effect on me, and I certainly didn't want it for my children. And that was really important to me, that I gave both my children stability. I wanted them to be in the same schools and to stay in the same schools, and they did. So I think it probably has had some sort of psychological effect on my life. But, you know, other people have to deal with far worse things than that. And I did get the benefit of having a wonderful, interesting travelling life as well. So, you know, I can't complain.
Do you find it easy? Do you ever use any of those settings for your books?
Abroad settings?
Yeah.
I never have. No, actually, that's not true. I've used a holiday setting for the end of one of my books, Barbados, where I went on holiday. That did creep in, but no, I haven't. And I suppose it's because they're quite distant memories now. Mm. You know, I was very, very small in the Far East and not that old in the Middle East. But actually, I wouldn't necessarily rule it out, but I'd have to go back and refresh my memory, you know. And that probably would be a very enjoyable sort of research.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say about going out and speaking to people and all that, but I think you're a natural guest, to be honest with you, Jackie. I think you are a natural, if I'm totally honest. So I think
that's very kind of you to say so. Definitely doesn't come naturally.
Oh, and the events. I did my first event the other day, book event, and I work as a TV journalist, and everyone said, well, it's so different, A, when you're talking about your own book, A, yes. B, when you're talking about yourself, and yeah. C, when you're standing up in front of people reading your book. I was terrified.
Oh, I bet you did wonderfully well.
Thanks, Jackie. Luckily enough, a lot of good friends were in the audience. I never know if that's a good thing. Sometimes I find it easier when you don't know them. They're like, oh, God.
Look, it is to a certain extent. I remember my first event was Skullduggery at Stowmarket, and it was the inaugural one. It was the first time they'd ever done it, and I was so nervous about doing this, and I can't do ad lib at all, not in the slightest. And I was so worried about this, I learned a half hour speech by heart.
Well done.
Every single day for about 4 months leading up to that, so that I wouldn't lose my words.
And did it work?
Yes, it worked. I probably sounded like a robot.
Yeah,
but
you got it all out.
It's not the same as natural speaking, is it? But I actually managed to remember it all, which, considering my appalling memory, was no small feat.
And in front of all those people, I think that's incredible. I can't barely remember my words for like a 2 minute live report. Skullduggery and Scunthorpe. That sounds amazing.
Stowmarket. Skullduggery and Stowmarket. Suffolk Book Festival. It was lovely, and it was quite. I was in awe. There were writers like Ellie Griffiths was there. I mean, she's obviously a huge author, and my name is rotten, so I can't remember who all the others were, but they were all head and shoulders above me. I was this little self-published author invited because it was very local, you know, very local writings, and they were all these wonderful, and I spent the whole time fangirling, you know, just looking at these writers with awe.
Well, you did it, but you were there, Jackie, and your book's in Asda's, and they're going to Holland now, so come on, that is, I mean, flipping heck, that's amazing. So your advice, Jackie, for somebody listening, I mean, because I, you know, you are really doing it when it comes to, we say, like, next chapter living, it's like creating a life you love, doing things you love, living in places you love, and you're doing absolutely, with people you love, you're absolutely doing all of this, and you truly have created this world for yourself, having sort of come back there you know, with your family, with your work, with the writing, with the fascination, with the genealogy, all of it. You've done it all on your own terms and with your own. So it's really incredible. If someone's listening to this, first of all, thinking, I'd love to do something like that. I love the way Jackie's got her writing routine, or it might not be writing, it might be art, pottery, something, anything at all, or a new job, a complete new job. But I just think I've left it too late. What would you say to that person?
Never too late. Never, never, never. It's a mindset. You can do anything that you want to do. I mean, I didn't start writing. I must have been in my late 40s, I think, before I started writing and publishing and doing that sort of thing. And, you know, you can do whatever you want at any stage in life. I've made major career changes in the last few years. There's so much I want to do and I will do. And I know inspirational people. I've known people who've wing walked into their 80s and people who have, you know, finished master's degrees in their 70s. I don't think there's any bar to it. The only bar to a next chapter is if you stop trying. But why stop trying? That, you know, just go for it, do it.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree. And you must see it as well in some of, even back in these old times that you research and you see the characters and obviously we think, like when you were speaking before about the woman and the poverty and what they had to overcome, and what the world we live in today, touch wood, a lot of us, you're not living with quite like in those conditions, but you must have see a lot of inspiration that did happen and what they overcame back then as well.
Yeah, I mean, every bit of research you do, you know, every book I write is unfortunately nearly always based on a murder or a serious crime. So there's victims and their families are always having to, you know, they have to go on and they have to be strong and rise above it. And things were so hard back then, in, as I say, in a way that's almost unbelievable to us now, even just getting through the day, you know, even just finding your next meal and, you know, the subjugation of women as well. If you go back far enough, how difficult it was just to be a person and just have a thought and an idea, or the suffragettes who fought so hard for, you know, their right to vote and that sort of thing. There's so much strength out there, and there is now today in all of us. It's just different times, and it's just a matter of searching in yourself for your strength and deciding what you want to do and absolutely going for it.
And do you see that, is that one of the reasons as well why you do, like, you write about murders and that, I suppose, to see what it's all kind of a bit what people are capable of, the good and the bad?
Yeah, you never know what you're going to get. People show you what they want you to see, but scratch beneath the surface and you might have a really wonderful, kind person, or you might have an absolute raging psychopath. You don't know what's out there, and you know, people don't necessarily present the way they really are. And I mean, I guess there is a psychological aspect to it. I'm no psychologist, but you know, there must be, I must observe people perhaps more than I realise that I do, because, you know, you have to understand how minds work for good and for bad to be able to put together these sorts of books and recognise these qualities in people.
Yeah, it is. I have this conversation, the reason I ask, I have this conversation a lot with my husband, because obviously he writes a lot of crime, but my fiction is like up, you know, the other end of the scale. But I think the more I look at it, I think it's actually, we are actually on the same page, just on the different ends of the scale as such, because it is a fascination. My books, it's always a fascination with people, like how they fall in love and what makes them fall in love and all different things like that, but and become who they want to be. It's kind of it's a fascination. You say it about psychology, but see, I think you can be with me in my amateur psychology, Jackie. I'm, you know, it's never stopped me from having a go. I don't know what I'm talking about, but I do find it fascinating thinking about it. And so if someone's listening to this, Jackie, and they say, well, look, but Jackie, she brought it out with her genealogy and her writing. I wish I had something I could feel passionate about, but I don't. And I just don't know. I know I've got something in me, but I don't know what it is. How would you suggest to that person that they start to try and find it?
I suppose Quiet times, during quiet times, I think, you know, inspiration often strikes when you're least expecting it. And you don't have to have a hobby or an interest. You can be walking in the field with a dog, and you can see something or hear something. And I have on my phone just lists of ideas as I'm walking along, and I might see or hear a thing or see a person or even a gesture or something like that. And that might trigger something. I actually believe that everybody does have a book in them, and I think it's whether they're disciplined enough to write it or not, really, more than whether their imagination will go there, because your imagination will go anywhere. If you sit in front of the television and watch a movie, your imagination will go along with that movie, and you'll be several steps ahead trying to work out what happened next. And, you know, even standing in the shower doing absolutely nothing, you won't be staring at the wall thinking nothing. Your mind will be racing ahead, and you'll have some level of inspiration or thoughts in there. It's just a matter of pulling it out, working out what interests you, and then making yourself sit down and just penning a few sentences, just a few words, and see what happens. See if that those words become sentences and those sentences become paragraphs and so on and so forth.
Like what you said, it was a chapter and then it was a book and then it was the marketing. Yeah. And it feels so overwhelming at the beginning with anything, but it is the tiny steps, isn't it? It really is.
Oh, it is.
It's so good. So finally, Jackie, so my dream is to write a book that somebody would read on holiday, that would they'd read it in a day or, you know, very quickly and then discuss it. I'd love that. You know, when you see something, they can't put it down. Yeah. And then they chat with their husband or partner, whoever, friend, about it when they, you know, having their bubbles like you were on holiday. What would you say? What is the book that you couldn't put down on holiday that you would recommend?
Oh, actually, it was a J.K. Rowling book called The Running Man. And I, for some reason, I had never read, because she wrote it under Robert Galbraith, I'd never read any of that series. But it was set in East Anglia, which obviously is where my roots are. It was absolutely fascinating book. It was all set around a cult, and I sort of picked it up, you know, in the used books part of your holiday where everybody dumps their holiday reading. And I just picked this thing up, and it was the size of a tombstone. It was a massive book. It was really, whoever bought it was well worth the money. And I sort of opened it up, not expecting much particularly, because although I love the Harry Potters, I didn't see how that was going to translate very well into this thing. And I literally didn't put it down again. I sort of got uneven tan shapes from having that big book on my lap while I was sunbathing. It was absolutely fabulous. It was the Cameron Strike series, which they've made into films as well, series as well. And yeah, that was by far my recent best read. But I downloaded your book last week, which I am yet to start. So maybe that will be the next one.
I hope that doesn't give you a tan mark. Maybe
I'm excited for it. I'm excited to read it.
Oh, well, how lovely, how supportive. And yeah, oh, well, I feel very touched. I wasn't expecting that, Jackie, so thank you so much. But look, Jackie, you weren't expecting this, so to enjoy this. You have been a truly amazing guest. You are a natural podcast guest. I can't wait to come and see you speaking and see your books in Holland as well. Jackie, thank you so much for being such a wonderful guest on The Next Chapter.
Thank you for having me.
So there you are. Oh, I love that so much. The power of Jackie's writing routine twice a week, and look where it has taken her. And I also love that, the tiny steps. You don't have to have it all figured out. You just need to keep taking them and making it work for you. Now, to learn more about Jackie and her wonderful books, the link is in the show notes. And don't forget, if you enjoyed the extract from my novella, Could We Just Do That Again? Or you can download your copy absolutely for free at elliebarkerwrites.com. The link is also in the show notes. And before you go, we'd love to stay in touch. Cookie and I will send you a little note every other Friday, 3 pieces of Next Chapter inspiration, more of these conversations, the hurdles I'm facing and how I'm overcoming them in my own next chapter, and quotes from my novels and wisdoms I'm learning along the way. We hope they help you feel you're never alone and there is always another way. So we'll be back next time, but until then, don't forget those tiny steps take you to where you want to go. I think you can do it, and Jackie does too. Speak soon.